What must I do? I'm a member of parliament. When a matter is being brought to me, to this is the position. The parliament must not know. We must only hear from the structure which has been seen to be racist. The truth of the matter is that this, in this particular case, it is not Mr. Bodlani who has uttered racist statements. What he has said is that I'm being discriminated because I'm black. This is what has happened. I'm being put in to go and stay in temporary structures where there are no toilets, and yet, and in place of a white woman who must stay in that particular office of mine. This is why I say in this particular thing, there's more to it.
Can you
if
summarize?
You are saying that you should be blinded. I agree.
Can you summarize?
Pardon?
Can you summarize? Can you conclude?
Yes, okay. All I'm requesting is that before the suspension is confirmed by this committee, can we get more information? Even if we ask them to go and interview Ms. Bodlani and then bring it to us, the information, whatever. But let us not be rubber stamps of what the commission is saying. Let us find out more before we make a temporary suspension. That's what I'm requesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Mufuke.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the report. Chair, I do understand that this is a provisional suspension. And you are correct to say that this matter is still debatable. And I support the provisional suspension. I want to further go and say that looking at the matter as it came, does it make the commission to understand that there are many other cases of domestic violence that are treated like this by magistrates? And if that is the case, will they look at the issue that was raised by the president to say cold cases should be brought forward? Are they ready for them? Because it's a fact, it's happening, and then domestic violence as it is, that's why we don't have convictions in a big way, and we still keep on complaining. Lastly, say, Chair, it's also looking at making life difficult, very simple for people, because for matters to come to them, sometimes the public can't because they are refused with transcripts. Are they aware of that? And also something that they must also wake up to it, they must communicate the decisions of the magistrate commission because they are never communicated. That's why people will come on complaining that they are doing nothing. Thank you for now, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Deputy Minister.
Chair, thanks. It was to start responding. I don't know if there's any other members who want to come in.
I'm not seeing any other member, DM.
Okay. All right. No, just because there are a few issues. I mean, the other...
Masiko Jelo is on.
She has spoken. Speaking again.
Yeah, she has spoken. Yes.
Oh, okay.
No, Chair, just a few things. I thought I needed to respond to Honourable Mpumlwana, who I wasn't actually aware as a member of this committee. He had been in the previous Parliament, and but just to raise that if you look at paragraph 37 of the report, the Commission talks of, or said that in January she was invited to show cause why she shouldn't be provisionally suspended, and her attorneys, Rakesh Maharaj and company, submitted a four-page letter to that regard. So I'm not sure what the issue is around hearing her sides. On the issue of the allegations of racism, I think that is in the report, or the commission can speak about that, was investigated. I am not sure if the Honourable Mpumlwana has read any of the review judgments. relating to the sentences that were given and the things that she said. And I'm not sure, I didn't notice any issues relating to race in those in those review judgments. Look, the commission can explain the detail. She has already been provisionally suspended with salary. That was done by the minister, and Parliament's job, both houses, is to confirm that while the investigation carries on. But I think also that it is unfortunate for members to cast aspersions on the commission, which some of the members here are members, without coming up with the facts, with the details. Let me just also say, there was a point that Honourable Jankies raised relating to suspensions. Again, maybe the Ms. Advocate Musa can explain, but my understanding is basically the ministry is dependent on the commission for everything. I mean, and that is to protect the independence of the magistrates. So the minister cannot suspend anybody summarily. It has to be a recommendation from the commission. The minister cannot remove anybody as a magistrate. It has to be a recommendation from the commission. So I'm not sure if I've understood that issue correctly that he wanted to put to the minister. Then just on the issue of her acting, and again the officials can give more detail. But I just wanted to explain it because things have changed a bit. She was appointed as an acting regional magistrate on the recommendation by the minister, then minister, that would have been Minister Khadebe, on the recommendation of the commission in November 2013. The situation then was that although they were being appointed on effectively probation, and they were effectively acting magistrates, there was meant to be a probation period in which their performance was assessed, and they would then be permanently appointed. But it wasn't a normal probation. In a normal probation, you can get rid of the person if they're not performing. Once the minister had appointed a magistrate or a probationary magistrate, you were not able to get rid of them. So she basically had to continue to act because there wasn't any basis for her not to be appointed. That situation has changed now in that probationary period is no longer there. Once the minister appoints, they appoint. That's the reason for the long acting. Her appointment wasn't confirmed because of these problems. And that's why she's still officially acting magistrate Budlani, but she's a different status to an acting magistrate who just gets appointed on a contract on a regular basis. She's almost de facto permanent. So I just wanted to explain that detail as well. Thanks.
Thank you very much, DM. Mr. Musa or Mr. Dawood?
Yes, thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I think in respect of the first question, the Honourable Deputy Minister has also already dealt with the acting from the 2013 until today. And I think he also has indicated or taken the question of Mr. Werner Horn relating to the long acting period. I think in respect of the point that has been made by the Honourable Member Jankies relating to the systemic challenges, I'm just going to hand over to Mr. Mohammed, the Secretary of the Commission, just to explain the way forward and what has transpired. But I just want to indicate that I think on the last occasion when we did appear before both the houses, both the committees, we in fact had dealt with some of these systemic challenges. But I think in relation to the points that have been made, the Magistrates Commission has in fact engaged. And I think I'll just ask Mr. Dawood Mohammed just to perhaps maybe give the committee an update relating to the way forward. Mr.
Yes, Jefferson, thank you very much. The matter was discussed at the last commission meeting, and subsequent to that, the chairperson decided that as part of the discussion of the meeting, that this matter will be taken aside. And a meeting has been scheduled for EXCO to meet on the 16th of September. That is one of the aspects that will be discussed. There were a number of issues that were raised, and the issue of the systemic challenge is one of the aspects that was raised. That is going to be discussed on the 16th of September, after which a resolution is going to be adopted by EXCO and then presented to the full commission on the way forward as to how we're going to approach the issue of the systemic challenges in a form of a report. So I do believe that that matter will also be presented to Parliament very shortly. Thank you.
Honourable Shepherds, may I then proceed further?
Yes.
Thank you. And lastly, I just want to take the comments made by Honourable Member Mpunwana relating to the investigation that he conducted. I want to give the members of the committee the utmost assurance that the Magistrates Commission simply does not operate on any racist agenda. We operate simply on the objective facts as they come before us. You will observe, and quite correctly, as the Honourable Deputy Minister has indicated, Ms. Botlani was given a fair opportunity to respond to the allegations that are contained in the report in paragraph 3. She engaged the services of an attorney, and based upon the response from Ms. Botlani, it was clear to the Magistrates Commission that the evidence was overwhelming, and the clarion call simply was that it will call for a provisional suspension from office. I want to also give the honourable members the comfort that there are numerous checks and balances in place when it comes to this particular process. The investigator goes out and gets information. Once the information is received, a report is prepared. It comes before a committee, the ethics committee, that's comprised of 10 different members, all of different race groups, that deal with these particular matters, and no particular racist agenda is operating at that point in time. In addition thereto, once the ethics committee makes a decision, that decision is sent through to the full meeting of the Magistrates Commission that comprises of minimum 30 members. It is the entire Magistrates Commission that then looks at the evidence, interrogates it, and thereafter decides whether there is merit in the allegations, and thereafter endorses the recommendation made by the Ethics Committee. So in the circumstances, I respectfully would beg to differ with the unsubstantiated comments made by the Honourable Member relating to the fact that there's been a racist agenda. There are numerous checks and balances in place that would clearly indicate that the Commission does its work without fear, favour or prejudice. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honourable, Mr. Mr. Dawood and Mr. Mohammed. I just thought that I must just ask you one issue which has not been part of a presentation, but we were asked by the suspended magistrate, magistrate in KZN. I think he has been the judge, he has been the magistrate, president.
Yes, sorry, regional court president in Zimande.
Yes, regional court in Zimande. He was suspended a long time ago, and up to now he has not, according to him, he has not been through the disciplinary processes. If you can just answer that before we conclude this matter.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. That particular question I'd like to hand over to Mr. Hans Meyer, who is on the ground with that particular investigation. Mr. Hans Meyer.
Thank you, Chair. I think there's just back of my mouse.
Chair, the draft charge sheet has already been, well, of course, a long time he's been charged with misconduct. The charges has been served on him. He appointed a legal team to represent him at the inquiry. At the moment, we are just waiting for the persons getting the evidence to liaise with Mr. Zimandi's legal team to have a kind of a pre-trial conference, but it would be sui generis, just to eliminate all the problems and disputes before we start with the trial, with the hearing. So in the meantime, Ms. Swart, who is the investigating officer, she is still busy with her report in relation to other complaints and allegations of misconduct against Mr. Zimandi, and she will file that report by the end of October. So in that regard, there may be even additional charges leveled against Mr. Zimandi, and that we told him, and we specifically raised that in our letter to him when we served the charges on him, as well as to invite him to show cause why he should not be released and suspended from office at the time. So it takes some time. It's a voluminous documentation. We have more than 50 boxes of evidence already. But we are in the process of really setting a date for the hearing to commence. But unfortunately, it's a complicated matter. There's a lot of allegations, and it took a lot of time, I know. But we will correspond with him, the chairperson, with his legal team.
No, thank you very much. I think let me raise the issues that the members have raised. First of all, I think also on our side, we said we will write to the judge responsible for the Magistrate Commission to have a meeting with him. And that is still a process that we are committed to do. The challenge that we have is that our program is extremely tight between now and the end of the year. But we are concerned with the issues that Honorable Janja raised, and we want to make a follow-up. But it would be, because I think the issues that he has raised are not only limited to the delays. I think they will be far-ranging. They will cover a lot of issues, including the issues of races, the issues of black magistrates that are being suspended. So it will be a quite ranging kind of information that we would require from the Magistrate Commission in dealing with the systemic issues. And also the programs that should be in place in assisting the magistrate in dealing with gender-based violence. That is one of the issues that we would want from the Magistrate Commission. And not only for the magistrates, I suppose, even for the judges, and it will be part of our discussions with the Chief Justice, because we think that the issue of programs to sensitize the judiciary as a whole on issues of gender-based violence are very critical. The Magistrate Commission is a structure by law that we have passed a parliament that deals with the investigations. Any evidence or any suggestion that they are biased, there has to be a substantive motion brought before the committee. Today, what is before us that we have to decide on is whether there is a prima facie case that warrants suspension of Magistrate Botlane. And members, we are all in agreement that there is a prima facie case that Ms. Botlane should be suspended. By agreeing to her suspension, we are not saying that she is guilty. We are saying there is a prima facie case for her to answer there is still going to be an inquiry where she will be legally represented if she so wishes, a full-blown inquiry, which would recommend if she should be removed or not. If the inquiry finds that indeed there is no case against her, it will pronounce itself as such. But for all intents and purposes, as the members of the Portfolio Committee of Justice, we agree that she should be suspended. Thank you very much. Can we move to the second item? I think this has been dispensed with. Ms. Silkstone, can you brief us on the issues relating to the South African information regulator?
Sir, Honourable Chairperson, can we be excused?
Thank you very much to the Commission.
Thank you, Chair.
Good morning. I'm just sticking my headphones in. Good morning. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
I've been asked today just to run through the appointment process applicable to members of the information regulator. And it's going to be a very brief presentation because I sent out a longer document late last week. So the matter was referred to the committee on the 20th of November 2019, and it requires the committee to nominate a suitable person to fill the position, the vacancy that was left when Professor Tana Pistorius resigned from the information regulator. Just to say that the information regulator consists of five members, a chairperson, two full-time members, and then two part-time members. The ordinary members are, one is appointed to take care of the papier responsibilities, and the other one is appointed to take care of the papier responsibilities. So in my larger document, I have a brief bio of all the members, but just to say briefly that they are all have a legal background, and some actually practice law, but really they have diverse experience and qualifications. Professor Pistorius is an academic who specializes in the field of intellectual property law and ICT law. Okay. Then going on to the formal criteria for appointment, members, the people who are appointed must be appropriately qualified, fit and proper people or persons, at least one of which must be appointed on account of having experience as a practicing attorney or advocate or professor of law at a university. Then in terms of disqualifications, the following people are not eligible for appointment: the person who's not a citizen, a public servant, a MP, MPL, or a member of a municipal council, an office bearer or an employee of any political party, an unrehabilitated insolvent, and someone who's been declared mentally ill or unfit, and someone who's been convicted of any offence involving dishonesty. Then just to go on to the appointment process, and this is really quite a familiar one, the president appoints the chairperson and the members of the information regulator on the recommendation of the National Assembly. The National Assembly must recommend persons who have been nominated by a multi-party committee of the Parliament of the National Assembly and approved by the National Assembly by a resolution adopted with a supporting vote of the majority of the members of the National Assembly. In terms of the term of office, members are appointed for no more than 5 years, and they are eligible for reappointment. The process for filling a vacancy is the same one as the one that we follow when we appoint. The only thing is that when a vacancy arises, unless the committee or the House recommends that the period of appointment is longer, the person will then fill for the remainder of the term of the office that is becoming vacant. Now, the committee had a discussion about this before, and this is just a reminder, and it was agreed that we would recommend the appointment for 5 years. Then just to say that the committee process to date is we've advertised, we received 25 applications or nominations, and we had 2 withdrawals. So there are 23 candidates to consider. And then finally, I just thought about some considerations that maybe need to be discussed. And here it's how many candidates will be shortlisted, because that will obviously affect our time for interviewing. The process that would be followed in terms of shortlisting, the interview structures and the length of the interviews and the use of questions, and then also when would screening take place. Bear in mind that screening is not the same as vetting. Thank you. That's the end of my presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Silkstone. Members, do you have any questions on the presentation made by Ms. Silkstone?
Just one.
Honorable Ngola.
Thank you very much, Chair. No, I just want to check. The report is saying a person can be nominated to serve for a period of not more than 5 years, but eligible for re-election. I just want to check on the re-election part. Is there an identified number of terms a person can serve, or a person can serve indefinitely in the information regulator as long as they get re-nominated or re-elected? Thank you very much.
If you remember, Honorable Mola, Advocate Kakula raised that issue, I think last year, that the law currently allows a person to be reappointed as many times as it is possible. And she was even suggesting that maybe we should consider amending the legislation to have a time limit. So it was raised, but currently the legislation as it is now, a person can be reappointed as many times as it is possible.
All right, sir. I think let's just take note of it. Then yes. When we're done with this process, we'll then have a way of dealing with it.
Sure. Thank you very much. Honorable Mohammed.
Just a small one. The vacancy, if I understand, this is the part-time vacancy. Is that correct? Just to confirm.
It's correct. It's correct, Honorable Mohammed.
Thanks.
So, Honorable Members, we'll be conducting the shortlisting on Friday. The issue is generally, I think we need to agree on the number of people that would need to be shortlisted, bearing in mind that this is a part-time position, and the number of days we think we want to do the interviews, I think that would be important. And I think we need to decide on the issue of screening, whether we will follow the same process as the one we followed with the Deputy Public Protector, where the members of the public would be allowed also to raise issues with the candidates, and how long should we allow that process to take? Honorable members, I have Honorable Ngola, do you want to come back?
noted just on the matter of shortlisting how many and how many days.
Thanks.
No, I think one that it is befitting for us to commend the work we've done in the process of the deputy bulb protector. And it has set a benchmark across board. I think we must not deviate too much, as much as we're going to ensure that it's a different entity and that one is a different entity, but we must not deviate too much from it. Going to the number of people that we must shortlist and the number of days, I think they are interlinked because the more we shortlist people, the more days we need. But given the situation, I think for now let's take one day for the interviews. Then we take 5 people. Let's take one day for the interviews, then shortlist 5 people to be interviewed when we sit for shortlisting. It's a different environment now. We had free time then where people were able to travel, people were able to come and do their thing. So it's a different kind of environment that we're operating now. So I suggest that you take one day and take 5 candidates.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mola. So there's a suggestion that we take one day and we shortlist 5 people. What is the view of other members? Can I take it that we agree that we will take one day and we shortlist 5 people?
Yes, Chair.
We agree.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
It's Werner Hoorn.
Honorable Hoorn.
Yeah, I don't necessarily disagree. However, I would think it would not necessarily be the best route to follow to say that we are bound to identify 5 people to interview if there, for example, is only ultimately 4, which we, from the applications and the CVs and the relevant experience, deem to be worthy of being invited for an interview. I don't have a problem in saying that we should use 5 as more or less a guideline in terms of the number of people who should be interviewed for us to consider the matter properly. But I think similarly, we might be faced with a situation where there could be 4 or 6 people who ultimately are found by us on Friday, I think, when it is scheduled to be worthy of being interviewed. But with the general approach, I don't have an issue.
Okay. Now, if we get 3 or we get 4, that will still be fine. I think the issue is that we should not exceed 5 if possible.
I agree. I was just checking when is ESCOM cutting out Honorable Hoorn, but I support the 5 one.
Oh, wait, no, just remember when ESCOM cuts off the Honorable Hoorn, it's because you let ESCOM get into the state it's in.
Yeah, Chair, I think we must now in this committee, as it is, if you'll allow me, hold the Honorable Janky to a different standard. He must at all times now act as a person who is supposed to be impartial and objective if he wants to continue acting as a presiding officer. So you must protect me when he comes with his ANC tendencies, please.
It's very good that he acts as a presiding officer. It stops him acting as anything else.
Honorable members, let's focus. We have.
Can I quickly just make one share that to the Honorable Hoorn, that the only member of this committee the acting House Chair has dealt with in the House and sent out is an ANC member.
Honourable members, let's focus. We still have a long presentation on the cyber crimes, so let's really focus.
Chair, can I just come in? I'm already, the ESCOM has already dealt with me. When you see me disappearing, Chair, don't be surprised. I'm already on late shedding, but at least I'm still alive.
Okay, sure. So, honourable members, we agree on maximum of 5, but if we can do less, it's fine. We agree on 1 day. So the screening, when are we going to do the screening? Should it be after we have interviewed or before the interview? Because it is going to affect our project plan. Ms. Lookstone?
Yeah, as you've just said, Chair, if we screen beforehand, it will affect our program, and then afterwards, it would probably have less of an effect. Of course, the screening does bring very important information to the committee before they actually interview. So it's really up to the committee to decide.
Can I be guided by members? Because if we say let's screen, which means we'll have to revise the program, because the screening would take a couple of maybe a week, 2 weeks or so. Can I be guided by members? Because the issue is that with screening, some of the questions or issues that might arise out of screening, you would want to put them to the candidate for his or her response. If they say Magwanishe committed fraud, and that is the result of this, the outcome of the screening process, it would be fair to put that to me so that I can be able to explain.
Okay. I want to suggest that we follow the same route, that we look at maybe getting 2 weeks, and so that they can be able to deal with all the logistics. That is my suggestion on that.
Thank you very much.
Chair, Wilma?
Also Honorable Verma Horn. Honorable Horn?
Yeah, Chair, I think you just fused me and the Honorable Nivo Drachen into one member. So I'm not Velma Horn, I'm Werner Horn, but be that as it I agree with the colleague who suggested that we should at all times follow a process where we allow for the screening to be done in such a way that when by the time we arrive at the interviews, we have it in hand. If 2 weeks, I think if memory serves correctly, in the case of the Deputy Public Protector, I think 2 weeks ultimately turned out to be sufficient. So in this case, it should also be. Thank you.
Okay. Now, can I say to Honorable Nivo Drachens?
Hi. Yes, Chair. So it's Wilma. You can say Wilma. Not Wilma Hall, not Werner. No, it's fine. Just for clarity, the screening after the shortlisting, because shortlisting will be doing this Friday. So I just want to clarify that screening will be done after shortlisting. Just that point. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable Ms. Silverstone, it should be after the shortlisting.
Yes, yes, Chair. After the shortlisting.
After the shortlisting. So we would screen those that we have shortlisted. So, honorable members, given the decision we have taken today, we are going to readjust the program slightly to take into consideration the decisions of today. To do the screening and the weeks that will be allowed for the screening. But on Friday, we are doing the shortlisting. And then thereafter, we'll do the screening, then we'll do the interviews. The likelihood is that the interviews will be done in the next term if we have to include the 2 weeks of screening. I think thank you very much to members for the guidance, and thank you to Ms. Silverstone for the good work done, as always. Thank you very much, Ms. Stone, and to the honorable members. Can we now go to the presentation on the cyber crimes? And today we will generally be dealing with the background and the general briefing on the bill. It's not a bill that we will just do in one day. I think it will be important for today to just to get a presentation from the department, and then thereafter we will still in the next weeks or so try to conclude the bill. When I looked at the bill, it is technical, so we must allow that space so that members can follow properly, given that half of the members were not part of the committee that approved the bill in the National Assembly to the NCOP. So we thought it will be important that there is a brief, a background briefing first, so that members can be up to speed to understand what is in the bill. Over to you, Deputy Minister, and your team.
Chair, thank you. Mr. Cyril Robertson will make the see that the presentation is already on the screen. Just to remind members that this was a bill, you don't know the bill, this committee. It was passed by the previous, the Justice Portfolio Committee in the previous parliament, and by the National Assembly in the previous parliament, and went to the NCOP. It was revived, and they have then proposed amendments. It's a Section 75 bill, which means that what the committee has to do is to accept or reject those amendments. You can't make further amendments, but it's accept or reject. If you reject, unlike a Section 76 bill, if you reject an NCOP amendment, that's the end of it. In a Section 76 bill, if the National Assembly does reject it, then has to go to a mediation committee between the two houses. But as you had said, what we had thought was to give an overall briefing of the bill, because just to expect the committee, where most members are not familiar with the bill, to just look at the NCOP amendments may be unfair. So if I can hand over to Mr. Robertson, thanks.
Thank you, Deputy Minister, and Mr. Chairperson, and hello, committee members. My name is Cyril Robertson. I'll take you through the bill. I must warn you that my internet connection is very unstable, and I've got problems. I'm not going to put on my video for that instance. As introduction, cybercrime is a fast-going area of crime. The South African banking regulatory industry recently published statistics regarding cybercrimes. And in 2018, there were 23,206 incidents of cybercrimes affecting banks mostly, which give rise to a loss of 260 million rand. In 2019, there were 27,928 incidents of cybercrimes, which gives rise to a loss of 28.4 million rand. Outside the banking industry, there's no really any statistics available to see what the true extent of cybercrime in South Africa is. The FBI indicated that in 2019, cybercrime losses amounted to 3.5 billion rand. That is more or less the background and the necessity for this bill, mainly to address this kind of cyber crimes. South Africa has laws in place that criminalize certain conduct, which can be addressed as cyber crime. But in general, traditional laws, which is not just aimed to South Africa, but to other countries, is not very effective for that purpose. To evaluate the effectiveness of cybercrime legislation, the first thing to evaluate is obviously the substantive criminal law.
namely that specific conduct should be criminalized as cyber crimes. Secondly, procedural laws, and in South Africa we deal with Chapter 2 of the Criminal Procedure Act that is used to investigate cyber crimes, and the Criminal Procedure Act is object-based. You will see that nowhere in Chapter 2 any reference is made to computer investigations. Unlike traditional object-based investigations, cybercrime investigations usually deals with evidence that is incorporeal of nature. It's not a physical object, it's data or information. Next page, please. Sorry, I cannot do the slideshow from my side due to low bandwidth. The third issue is jurisdiction. If you look at cybercrime as such, cybercrimes has various transnational elements. The cybercrime can be committed from outside the country, can involve five other countries, and then at the end of the act, give rise to a criminal offense in the Republic. This must be addressed. You must make provision for broad jurisdiction to deal with cybercrime. International cooperation is very important, and that's mainly due to the transnational nature of cybercrimes, the other countries involved. And furthermore, if you look at the current laws in South Africa, that deals with international cooperation, and that is the Cooperation and Criminal Matters Act, you will see that it is also object-based and does not deal on a speedy basis with evidence that must be preserved. Usually, what happens in a cybercrime is that data that is needed for investigation is in another country, and data is frequently overwritten by other information. So if there's no speedy action to preserve that data will be lost. Your further component is your law of evidence. It must make provision for the admissibility of electronic evidence, that is the data that is obtained by investigators. A further element that is very important is cooperation with service providers. Service providers usually know what's going on the networks, and they have essential information at their disposal to assist with investigation of cybercrimes. Obviously, all laws, that is substantive and procedural law, must comply with the human rights law, and it must balance the respective interests of the victim or the state on the one hand, and on the other side, that of the accused person. Alignment with international trends and best practices is very important, mainly due to the fact that dual criminality and adherence to general accepted principles and standards in the investigation of cybercrime is essential for international cooperation. Next slide, please. Cybercrime is a crime that evolves at a phenomenal pace. If you train people, mainly your law enforcement agencies, to investigate cybercrime, their knowledge will be outdated fairly quickly. So in addition to your ordinary law enforcement agencies that investigate cybercrime, there's also a need for the involvement of experts that that is in the forefront of developments. And furthermore, cybercrime legislation should not be restricted to ordinary crimes that is traditionally regarded as cybercrime, but your general crimes that is committed by way of a cyber element should also be catered for in your cybercrime legislation. If you evaluate South African existing law, the result is that the law does not comprehensively and uniformly criminalize conduct that is internationally regarded as cyber crimes. Already pointed out that procedural laws that's used to investigate cyber crime has not kept pace with the more intrusive nature of investigations and additional actions that's required to investigate a cyber crime. In general, our law dealing with electronic evidence is sufficient. It's used daily in courts to admit incorporeal evidence. International cooperation already dealt with. Our International Cooperation Criminal Matters Act is not up to date or up to standard to deal with the investigation of cyber crimes. Must be pointed out that various countries, including African countries, have recently enacted cybercrime legislation to deal with cybercrimes. And this is South Africa's effort to come to terms with cybercrime. Next slide, please. I think the Deputy Minister already dealt with the history of the bill. I'm not going to deal with that, so we can skip the next two slides up to page 7. The next slide, please. Thank you. Can you just go one back, please? Thank you. During the process in the select committee, after considered after they considered the bill, did propose certain amendments to the bill. And these amendments focus on altering the tone of the bill, mainly to reflect a non-binary language, as is required by consideration of general neutrality, equality, dignity, and identity. The restructuring of Clause 16 that deals with the criminalization of the distribution of intimate images to specifically address the aforementioned concerns. Further amendments were proposed to Clauses 1 up to 59, and that gives effect to proposals that were made during the public hearing process, as well as further engagements with the South African Police Service and the National Prosecuting Authority. Various consequential amendments were affected to the bill as a result of the aforementioned amendments. And there were also various drafting amendments. The bill and the amendments were approved by the National Council of Provinces on 1 July 2020. Overview of the provisions of the bill. Well, the bill aims to rationalize the laws of South Africa into a single act to deal with cybercrime. And to that extent, the criminalized conduct considered as cybercrime criminalizes the distribution of data messages, which is harmful, and to provide protection orders to protect victims against the harm of such data messages. It further regulates jurisdiction in respect of cybercrime. It regulates the powers to investigate cybercrime. It regulates aspects relating to mutual assistance in respect of the investigation of cybercrime. Provides for establishment of a point of contact in the South African Police Service. It provides for proof of certain facts by way of affidavit. It imposes obligations on electronic communication service providers and financial institutions to report cyber crimes to the South African Police Service. Next slide. The bill still provides for capacity building. Sorry, next slide, please. Okay, let's continue from the top. It really provides for capacity building by the South African Police Service to investigate cybercrime. It provides that executives may enter into agreements with foreign states to deal with cybercrime, the investigation thereof, the prevention as well as the mitigation thereof. It repeals various provisions on the statute book that deals with conduct that is dealt with in the bill, and it provides for matters connected therewith. The first part of the bill deals with definitions, and clause one contains various definitions that is aimed at facilitating the implementation of the bill. Clause 1.2 aims to clarify the application of the Protection of Personal Information Act in respect of the offences in clauses 2 and 3 and 7 of the bill. Clauses 2 is unlawful access. 3 deals with the possession of intercepted information. And clause 7 of the bill deals with the acquisition and possession of passwords and access codes, etc. Next page, please. Chapter 2 deals with cyber crimes as well as malicious communications. Part 1 deals with cyber crime. Just want to discuss the elements of criminal liability in general, insofar as it relates to criminal conduct. Obviously, if offense is committed, criminal liability will only result if the state proves beyond reasonable doubt that the accused committed, firstly, an act that complies with the definitional element of the bill, that is the various offences in this chapter. The act must obviously be unlawful, and culpability. Unlawfulness in the context of criminal law as well as the bill is the absence of any grant of justification or defence recognised by law, which would justify the act that complies with the prescription. Culpability is comprised of two elements, namely fault and criminal capacity. Fault, in terms of the bill, the fault requirement is that of intention, namely dualis directus, dualis indirectus, and dualis eventualis. The bill does not establish any offence based on negligence. Criminal capacity is obviously that a perpetrator must have the ability to appreciate the wrongfulness, namely that he acts unlawful, and that the accused then conducted his actions in accordance with this appreciation of unlawfulness. The next slide, please. The first category of offences deals with offences against the confidentiality, integrity, availability of data, computers, computer programs, and computer data storage mediums. The offences under this category is first unlawful access to data, a computer program, or a computer data storage medium. That is contained in clause 2. Clause 3 criminalizes the unlawful interception of data, the unlawful possession of data with the intention, with the knowledge that it was intercepted unlawfully. And it also criminalizes the possession of data where the possessor is unable to give a satisfactory exculpatory account of such possession. Clause 4 criminalizes the use and possession of software and hardware tools, but it's only criminalized to the extent that those software and hardware tools is used to commit other offenses contemplated in the bill. Clause 5 deals with unlawful interference with data and a computer program. And Clause 6 deals with unlawful interference with a computer data storage medium or a computer system. Clause 7 of the bill deals with password-related offences. Next slide, please. The next category of offences relates to offences that is facilitated by cyber means. This is, to an extent, traditional offences, which is committed in cyberspace. Clause 8 deal with cyber fraud. Clause 9 deal with cyber forgery and uttering. And Clause 10 deals with cyber extortion. Aggravated offences in the bill is contained in Clause 11. And the first offence there is found in Clause 11.1, and that's certain offences against restricted computer systems. The second category of aggravated offences is certain offences that is committed. Furthermore, in the bill, a provision is inserted, more or less as an instruction to the court, to say that the offence of theft must be interpreted to include the theft of incorporeal. That's contained in Clause 12. Next slide, please. Chapter 2, and that's contained in Part 2, deals with malicious communications. The malicious communications that is criminalized in terms of Part 2 is a data message that incites damage to property or violence, that is contained in Clause 14. Clause 15 deals with data messages that is disclosed that threatens persons with damage to property or violence. And Clause 16 deals with the disclosure of a data message of an intimate nature without the consent of the victim who is portrayed in that data message. Part 3 of Chapter 2 deals with attempting, conspiring, aiding, abetting, inducing, inciting, etc., mainly participating in conduct to commit an offence. Next clause, please. Next slide, please. Next slide. Part 4, Chapter 2 deals with competent verdicts. Competent verdicts is usually certain verdicts that a court, competent verdicts is usually where a person is charged with one category of offences, but the court can also convict the person of other offences which has similar elements as the offence of which the accused have been charged. And that is also in the Criminal Procedure Act. It's standard in most foreign legislation as well. Part 5 of Chapter 2 deals with sentences. And the offences in Clauses 2 to 7 is punishable with a fine or imprisonment from 5 to 10 years. Offences contemplated in Clauses 8 to 10 and 11.2 is punishable with certain minimum sentences or sentences that is in the discretion of the court. The contravention of Section 11.1 is punishable with imprisonment up to 15 years. And there's also certain aggravated circumstances that is prescribed that the court must take into account when certain of this offences is committed. Next slide.
Part 6 of Chapter 2 provides for orders to protect complainants from the harmful effect of malicious communications. Clause 20 provides for interim protection orders pending finalization of criminal proceedings. In terms of the protection orders, a court may prohibit a person from further disclosing a data message contemplated in clauses 14, 15, and 16. The court can also order an electronic communication service provider to remove or disable access to such data messages. Electronic communication service provider is further compelled to assist the court during proceedings as contemplated in clause 20, that is the application, to make particulars available of a person who distributed the malicious communication, or particulars regarding electronic communication service provider whose service is used to disclose or host such a malicious communication. That is firstly to ensure that the order as contemplated in clause 20 can be served on the person, as well as the electronic communication service provider. Part 3 provides for orders on the completion of criminal proceedings, which a court can issue to further prohibit the distribution of a malicious communication, or also to destroy a malicious communication.
Next page, please.
Next slide. Next slide, please. Sorry, next slide. Next slide, please. Next slide. Mr. Chairperson?
No.
Hey, next slide. Can somebody just go to the next slide?
Chair, there seems to be a problem with, I don't know who's organizing the slides, but maybe they might have connectivity problems, but we seem to have got on slide 15. Can I suggest to you, if it can't be resolved, that Mr. Robertson then just speaks to the remaining slides until this is resolved?
Yeah, I think he must continue in the meantime. Bonani, can you turn to the issue?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Clause 24 of the bill provides for appropriate jurisdiction to deal with the transnational dimension of cybercrime. It gives extensive jurisdiction to a court to try offences which is partly committed not within South Africa, or even committed against a South African citizen outside South Africa. Thank you, Rebecca. Chapter 4 deals with the investigation of cyber crimes. This chapter aims to supplement the Criminal Procedure Act. And I already pointed out the Criminal Procedure Act doesn't adequately provide for the investigation of cyber offences. And furthermore, if you look at the South African jurisprudence, various safeguards have already been developed, mostly around a warrant for search and seizure in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, to establish safeguards and conditions which must be complied with if you want to search or seize an object. Clause 26 is an important clause here. It deals with the issuing of standard operating procedures
That must be issued by the South African Police Service. Standard operating procedures aim to provide for procedures that must be adhered to if you investigate a cyber offence, and that is mainly aimed at maintaining the integrity of evidence which is later going to be used in a court. Next slide if you can. In general, a search warrant is necessary to search and seize for an article involved in the commission of a cyber offence. That is set out in clause 29. Applications for a search warrant can also be made orally, and that is to cater for incidents where a person is at a site to investigate a cyber crime and suddenly realize that the warrant must be extended to include other articles. Obviously, if a person with lawful authority to consent to a search and seizure, do consent to such a search and seizure, a warrant is not necessary. That is dealt with in terms of section 31 of clause 31 of the bill. Provision is made that a police official may, in exigent circumstances, search for and seize an article if the police official on reasonable grounds believes that a search warrant will be issued to him, but the delay in obtaining such a search warrant will defeat the objects of the search. In terms of the bill that was approved by the Justice Portfolio Committee, a search warrant is required in all instances to access a computer device and to search and seize data on that device after it has initially been seized by the South African Police Services. But the Select Committee affected amendments to this provision in question, and they allow the police, similar to Section 22 of the Criminal Procedure Act, in certain circumstances, to search and seize without a warrant. That is subject to a reasonable need by the police officials that conduct the search, that the search warrant will be issued to him, and the delay in obtaining such a warrant will defeat the object of the search. That is contained in clause 32. Clause 33 provides for the eventuality where a person is arrested for an offence and that the police official who searched that person may seize an article, that is a computer, for instance, in his possession. In terms of the Portfolio Committee bill, a warrant is required to access the computer and to search data on such a device. Again, the Select Committee amended this section to provide, similar to Section 22 of the Criminal Procedure Act, that the South African police official may access such a device on the grounds of a reasonable belief that the search warrant will be issued, and again, that the delay in obtaining such a warrant will defeat the object of the search. In various provisions of the bill, amongst others, clause 29(3), 32 and 33, provision is made that a police official may appoint investigators to assist with the investigation of cyber crimes. In so far as it relates to clause 29(3), investigators can also be authorized in terms of the search warrant to assist the police. And that is to cater for the constant and evolving nature of cybercrime, and the expertise is needed to assist the police to conduct the search and seizure. Next slide, please. Clause 34 imposes obligations on persons in electronic service providers and financial institutions to assist the South African Police Service in the investigation of a cyber crime. Clause 35 deals with obstructing or hindering of a police official or investigator, an authority of a law enforcement agency to overcome such resistance. Various clauses in Chapter 4 of the Bill deals with a place or provides for a scales clause to ensure that the powers to investigate offences must be exercised with strict regard to decency and order and with due regard to the rights and responsibilities and legitimate interests of other persons in proportion to the severity of the offence, and that is contained, amongst others, in clauses 36, 41 and 42. Clause 37 provides that if the power to search and seize is not authorized in terms of the bill, it is a criminal offense, and it also provides for civil liability that may follow in that regard. Furthermore, the disclosure of information relating to an investigation is similar in terms of Section 59, and that is to ensure that information about an infinite investigation is not distributed to other persons who may then interfere with such an investigation. There is exemptions to this disclosure or this criminalization of disclosure of information. Amongst others, if Act of Parliament authorised the disclosure of such information. Next slide, please. Clause 40 of the bill demarcates the provisions of the RICA vis-à-vis the bill. The RICA is there to intercept indirect communications and real-time communication-related information mainly, and the bill provides that if this procedure must be followed, it must take place in terms of the RICA. This is also inserted in clause 29 of the bill that deals with search warrants, which makes it subject to this restriction. A magistrate cannot issue a search warrant, amongst others, to obtain real-time communication-related information on an ongoing basis or to intercept indirect communications. Clause 43 mainly deals with the obligations of certain electronic communication service providers that is obliged in terms of the RICA to have a system that can intercept communications, and where there's also obligation on them to store communication-related information, but the direction was not issued to them in terms of Section 32 of the RICA to specify what they must do. So, Clause 43 mainly ensures that through preservation mainly, that real-time communication-related information can be obtained and preserved by such service providers for use in a criminal investigation. And that I'll discuss some of the provisions which is applicable to them later on in the slideshow. Next slide, please. The law provides for a procedure that's called the expedited preservation of data procedure, where a police official can issue a direction to a service provider and to request them to store certain information for a period of 21 days. That is provided in clause 41. It further provides for a preservation of evidence direction, and that's contained in clause 42 and 43, where a judicial officer can issue such a direction and tell a service provider to preserve other evidence or data for a period of up to 90 days.
Clause 44 deals with a procedure where this information or evidence that's under preservation can be made available. And law enforcement agency must apply to a judicial officer for a direction in terms of section 44. Application must contain. It also further stipulates what the requirements is, or rather requirements that must be met will be before a judicial officer may issue such a direction to search and seizure. And that's mainly to deal with addressing basic procedure to obtain information where search warrant is not necessary. Certain amendments were proposed by the Select Committee to this clause. I'm not going to discuss this, but the clause further provides that if an article that's evidence, let's say computer, is under preservation, that computer, hardware, or any evidence other than data must be searched and seized in terms of warrant contemplated in clause 29 of the bill. Clause 45 regulates the obtaining and using of public available data and also non-public available data that's obtained from a person who is in possession of such data. That's probably also very important in light of the Protection of Information, Protection of Personal Information Act. Next slide deals with mutual assistance and chapter 5 of the bill. Next slide. Okay, chapter 5 of the bill deals with mutual assistance between countries in the detection and investigation of cyber crimes and aims to provide some measures to preserve evidence or articles pending a request in terms of section 2 and 7 of the International Cooperation in Criminal Matters Act. The chapter provides for the following, namely information sharing between the South African Police Service and competent authorities of foreign states. Such information sharing is subject to conditions regarding confidentiality and limitation of use. One requirement is also that the information sharing must assist with the investigation of a cyber crime. That's contained in clause 47. Procedural aspects to be followed when a foreign state requests assistance from South Africa in a cyber crime is contained in clauses 48, 49, and 50. And so the designated judge may, on receipt of request for assistance, issue various directions to ensure that certain information that is required by a foreign state is preserved pending a formal application for mutual assistance. That's similar to the current process in terms of the International Cooperation of Criminal Matters Act and the procedure that applies in Section 7 of that Act will be followed, or should be followed, before that information can be made available to the other country. Exception is provided for in Clause 48, namely the sharing of traffic data. And traffic data exception is made that it can be shared on an expedited basis without dealing with the procedures prescribed in Section 7 of the International Cooperation in Criminal Matters Act. Clause 51 deals with procedural aspects that must be followed when South Africa requests assistance from a foreign state, in the investigation of a cyber crime, and that's also subject to Section 2 of the International Cooperation and Criminal Matters Act, namely that a formal application for assistance will be sent at a later stage. So this procedure is mainly to preserve evidence which can later be acquired. Chapter 6, and that's Clause 52, deals with the establishment of point of contact in the South African Police Service. The point of contact is an important structure in cybercrime investigations. It is proposed by almost every model law, the Budapest Convention and various other conventions dealing with cybercrime. The purpose of a point of contact is mainly to ensure that they can receive or request information regarding a cybercrime, and that they can provide assistance on a 24/7 basis. Some of the assistance that must be provided includes that of legal information that is necessary or that must be adhered to in South Africa. Chapter 7 deals with evidence, and it mainly provides for the admissibility of certain evidence by way of an affidavit or a solemn or a test declaration if it relates to anything that is related to information communication technologies. The ministers who, actually the persons who can make such affidavits need to be prescribed by the minister in safety. Next page. Chapter 8 of the bill. Chapter 8 of the bill deals with reporting obligations and capacity building. In terms of this chapter, electronic communication service providers and financial institutions are obliged to report categories of cybercrime to the South African Police Service and to preserve information that may assist in the investigation of a cybercrime. That's contained in the clause 54. Clause 55 imposes obligations on the South African Police Service to establish and maintain adequate human and operational capacity to detect, prevent, and investigate cyber crimes. And there's also a reporting obligation on the cabinet member responsible for police to report on the obligations that Clause 55 imposes on the South African Police Service. The further reporting obligation relates to the reporting of cyber crimes that was investigated, the status of such investigations, and whether this investigation resulted in prosecutions. Clause 56 imposes obligations on the National Prosecuting Authority to provide statistics for the prosecution of cyber crimes as contemplated in the bill. Next slide. Chapter 12 deals with general provisions. Clause 56 provides that a national executive may enter into agreements with other states, amongst others, to deal with mutual assistance and cooperation in the investigation of cyber crimes, as well as cyber crime response activities, training, the establishment of point of contacts to facilitate mutual assistance and cooperation, and also to address or implement measures to curb certain cyber crimes. The chapter further provides for the repeal or amendment of certain laws, and the laws in the schedule to the bill is therefore either amended or repealed. And in the schedule to the bill, all provisions in other legislation that deals with the criminalization of cybercrimes are appealed to extend that those provisions are substantially similar to the offences in the bill. The Crime Procedure Act is further amended to regulate bail in respect of certain offences. The Criminal Law Amendment Act or the Minimum Sentences Act is amended to include certain categories of offences in terms of the bill under the ambit of that act. There's amendments to the Criminal Law Sexual Offences Act, and this is quite important to take note of. The amendments, amongst others, criminalise the harmful disclosure of pornography, and similar to malicious communications, there's provisions inserted in the SOA to provide for protection orders to protect victims against harmful distribution of such communication. It also deals with child pornography. Child pornography was previously dealt with under the Terms and Publications Act. The Terms and Publications Act is amended, and child pornography is now inserted in the Sexual Offences Act, and it deals comprehensively with all child pornography offences and child pornography related offences. The Child Justice Act is also amended in the Schedule to the Act to prescribe sentencing options for minors that commit certain offences in terms of the bill. Thank you. That's an overview of the bill.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. I think going forward, it would be important as we deal with the bill that the binary language that was suggested by the NCOP, you highlight all those sections that it is just mere an issue of a binary language. And then after that, you highlight sections where there is a substantive amendment by the NCOP, so that we separate issues where, for instance, we would need to take a view as the National Assembly whether we agree with the binary issue or not. And then we come to the issues of where there are substantive changes done by the NCOP, where you would highlight those so that we have an easy document to go through. Your first document is 105 pages, and then the presentation is about 25 pages. If you can assist us, General, to have an easy document that you can work with. So let's be clear what was passed by the National Assembly. The areas that the NCOP has made substantive amendment, and the areas where the difference is just the issue of a binary language. Honorable members, the presentation has been done by the Department of Justice. Do you have any questions? I know Honorable Breitenbach has indicated that she wants to ask questions. I will also be noting other members who want to make ask questions and make comments. Let's start with Honorable Breitenbach.
Apologies, Chair. Comrade Wilmer would also like to comment.
Okay, Honorable Wilmer would also like to comment. Let's start with Honorable Breitenbach.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd just like to ask Mr. Roberts, it's not catered for in this law, but what is the plan going forward on how are we going to deal with cyber terrorism? If you could just highlight, if you could just update me on that, please. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Wilmer.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for the presentation. I only received the PowerPoint this morning, so I haven't had a chance to really scrutinize the PowerPoint presentation. But I would like to inform you that my computer will disconnect at some point, just so you know, but I want to ask my questions quickly. I understand that the Deputy Minister said that we are only approving the NCOP amendments, but I would like to know that if the committee wants to add anything further, and the reason why I'm mentioning it is that this bill came before cabinet in 2018. So today in 2020, there have been many changes in technology, and it's over 8 years actually since 2012. I mean, now we're working online, schools have classes online. So if there's anything that needs to be added or amended because of the technological updates in between the time the law was presented, how could we accommodate that? And in the last line in this slide, I wanted to comment, the last slide was really about children. So I wanted to know that if this cyber crimes bill, does it protect children? And the reason is that we have more and more children online, you know, doing schoolwork and classes, etc. And cyberbullying is online as well. So I haven't studied what the actual details, the actual definitions of cybercrimes in the bill. So that's why I'm asking, you know, is there protection for children, or maybe protection of children being victimized by other children? And then, yes, like I mentioned, the different definitions of cybercrimes. You know, the department only introduced the beginning. So they introduced the back and didn't go through all the different definitions. And in all of the years that the bill has been waiting to be passed, have there been any other changes in the definitions section that we might need to take note of? Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you very much. I think the Deputy Minister has already answered your first question. We are limited to accepting or rejecting the bill. If there are issues that we think that there has been substantial developments, we will have to, if we accept the bill, then we'll have to develop an amendment to the act, as it would have been accepted by the president. But we would not be allowed to add anything new to the bill. We either accept NCOP amendments or reject them. Then we can talk about what amendments we would want to make to the bill going forward. But now we are limited to, in terms of the procedure, to accept or reject. But I think the Deputy Minister and the team would answer the questions. I think, honorable members, because we were supposed to do the interviews for 2 days, so we will use those 2 days to finalize or to deal with this bill, so that we finalize this bill this term. That would be in September. So that will give time and space for the department to take into consideration all your comments that you would have made. Over to you, Deputy Minister, and to the team. Oh, before that, I also saw the presentation this morning, and you know, Deputy Minister, that we take serious exception to
late presentations of information, because as members we need to have time and space to read documents. So the documents are not for the convenience of the department. They are for the convenience of members, so that members can take right decisions. So we don't accept that presentations are going to be snipped in the morning of the presentations, or even a night before of the presentations. All presentations, be it slide presentation or the document presentation, would want enough time for us to interact with those presentations. Over to you.
Chair, sorry, weren't the other people who wanted to speak, didn't Ms. Breitenbach want to speak, or did I miss that?
She did.
She
there
did
was
speak.
No, yes, there was no one. There was no one. Maybe if I would imagine that you did not get the question. Honorable Breitenbach, can you kindly repeat the question?
Sure, it's not something that's covered by this bill. It's just what are we going to do about cyber terrorism? That's all.
Okay, Honourable Deputy Minister.
Sorry, no. Look, sorry, I did get that. I just had it just slipped. Look, I think most of the issues, Mr. Robertson will respond on. Let me just raise on the issue of non-binary. I mean, it's very, first of all, I think apologies for the late submission. I'm not sure when the original text document was sent, we'll make sure you get things earlier. The NCOP are quite strict and we seem to be able to manage with them. We must obviously do the same for the National Assembly. But apologies for that. On the issue of non-binary, look, it's quite simple. It's he or she becomes they. That's all. The issue, as far as I could see it from the NCOP, was there was a submission. There was a submission from CALS, the Centre for Applied Legal Studies, and I think a few other people, when it came to the display of intimate images, and that you couldn't display without permission a woman's breast. I mean, there's other things you can't display, but it was the issue in contention was woman's breast. And CALS had raised concern that was with binary. What about transgender people and so on? So that was then amended. What then happened was that, and then the issue was raised, well, look, seeing we're recognizing the existence of transgender people or intersex people, then why have it as a he or she bill and not just make it they instead of he or she? I think that, yeah, again, you've answered the point to Honorable Nivo Drushan, but it would be interesting to see what are the things that she is concerned about. Yes, things move very fast, but one tries to have legislation drafted that can accommodate the technological changes. I mean, what's interesting is the Protection of Personal Information Act. When we passed that bill, we had a huge argument around what was the platform now, but it was a platform that children used, and the issue of children disclosing their personal information on this platform. That doesn't exist anymore, that platform. It's moved on. And when we passed the Protection of Personal Information Act or bill, a lot of, I think there was Facebook, but I don't think there was Twitter then. Yeah, so we do try and ensure that legislation does accommodate changes that we may not know even know of their existence in the future.
I think let me get Mr. Roberts to answer the rest. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Deputy Minister, Mr. Chairperson. Regarding binary, in the South African legislation, you deal with concepts like he, she, or it, and that's usually sometimes repeated in text in legislation. There is international movement in international drafting practices to move away from the naming of all the inclusive gender in text, and even in some foreign legislation, he, she, what they, etc. So it's something that is used outside South Africa, and I think this is probably the first time that it's comprehensively used in a bill. So it's mainly drafting practices. My internet is very jittery. I did hear what provisions is in the bill that deals with the protection of children. And so I need to refer to mainly clause 14, 15 and 16 of the bill. Clause 14 of the bill deals with malicious communications that incite damage to property or violence against a person. It also deals with threats, the bill, clause 15 deals with threats, where you threaten a person with damage to property or violence. Your third offence that can cater for this is that of intimate images. On the other hand, there is the Protection of Harassment Act that comprehensively deals with harassing conduct. In the schedule to the bill, harmful disclosure of pornography and the protection orders is conduct that can be used to protect children in this regard. And I must also say that, look, this is probably the first steps that is taken by South Africa to comprehensively deal with malicious communications. Countries like the United Kingdom, Australia and New Zealand, Ireland, Canada, most of them has only recently published some research documents to deal with malicious communications. At some stage in the future, this can be broadened. But currently, I think, if you look at clauses 14, 15 and 16, Protection of Harassment Act, harmful disclosure of pornography, and especially the provisions in the Films and Publications Act that was recently amended, there is really, to an extent, sufficient measures in place to protect children against bullying. Regarding amendments to the Act to facilitate new technology, when the bill was developed in 2016, international best practices was followed. I'm not aware of any changes till 2016 that has been affected to any legislation of any country, that from my perspective will give rise to a need to change any provisions in the bill. It's like best practices international was followed, and it caters for mostly all technologies. Regarding cyber terrorism, the Honourable Ms. Breitenbach, there was a provision in the schedule to the bill that amended the South African Terrorism Act to deal with cyber terrorism. There's also various recent conventions that was adopted by the United Nations to deal with cyber terrorism. I think the United Kingdom in 2016 enacted amendments to the Terrorism Act to deal with use of the internet for terrorism purposes, etc. I acknowledge there's a need to deal with cyber terrorism, but there is current amendments to the Terrorism Act that is promoted by the Civilian Secretariat of the South African Police Services. I was to an extent involved in consultations regarding the amendments, and the provision that were in the bill is included in the amendments to the Terrorism Act, and it also provides for additional conduct of cyber terrorism. I don't know whether that bill has been approved or has been made available for public comment, but I think it does extensively deal with cyber terrorism. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robertson. Honorable members, do you still want to make comments? Or is there any member has questions? I see Honorable Mufuke. Any other member wants to make a comment on this bill? Honorable Mufuke.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks for the presentation. Chair, listening to the answers, there's a follow-up on what Honorable Velma was asking about the situations now, and it looks like the events have overtaken the bill, noting on what we have now been doing on virtual meetings and many other things. Are we not seeing that there's a problem of things that actually the bill was looking at, now things are developing even worse than before? Are they having any plans, or are there any observations that they have made on that that actually can be hampering on the bill going forward? And the last part is on, is the department not worried? And I think also parliamentarians should be worried about the looking at the submissions that were made. There were 14, and you look at also those that were invited. And among the submissions, you had an anonymous submission. And you know, you ask yourself, who's anonymous? And what is the intention of a person like that? And you look at the news today that the trans union, which is holding on a number of information of individuals, they are saying, please wake up, your IDs have been hijacked, or your information has been hijacked during COVID-19. What does it say to us now? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honorable Mfuke. Any other member? Mr. Robertson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Look, the virtual platforms was already there a long time ago. And when the bill was developed, virtual platforms and possible conduct that can amount to criminal activities relating to virtual platforms is catered for in the bill. Regarding new changes, yes, technology changes frequently. One aspect that is probably not fully catered for is that of cloud computing. But at this stage, it's the rest of the world is still trying to establish binding norms and principles in respect of investigation of evidence in the cloud. It's problematic aspects. It involves different jurisdictions. So aspects like that, there is other aspects that will arise in the future that need to be addressed. But the bill can be amended from time to time to cater for that. But I think the basis has been laid. This is actually it, and it can deal with almost all cyber crimes as well as all cyber investigations. Regarding the anonymous presentation that we received, it was not from the hackers group Anonymous. It was a very short representation. I cannot remember exactly what it was, but the person just didn't want to disclose his name. I cannot take it further. Thank you.
Thank you, honorable members. I would be guided by yourselves. Do we have an objection
to the NCOP amendments, do we still need 2 days that we can set aside to deal with this bill, or members are in a position to apply themselves now, or do we suggest that we reschedule the bill in those 2 days to deal with it clause by clause? Honourable Breitenbach.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think we can deal with it now.
Okay. Okay. You can proceed, Honourable Breitenbach.
I think we've dealt with this bill quite extensively, Mr. Chair. We've engaged with it. We've had a chance to study the amendments proposed by the NCOP. They appear to be sensible amendments. They're all incorporated, and I see no reason why we can't support the bill.
Mm. Thank you very much, Honourable Breitenbach. Honourable Mohammed.
Chair. We concur. The African National Congress, we support the changes, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Are there any objections? None. So we agree to all the amendments proposed by the National Council of Provinces. We will schedule for the debate to adopt the bill in the House. Thank you very much, Honourable Members. I think we have come to the end of the meeting. We will obviously be in contact with the leaders of political parties in the study group on the 2 days that we have at our disposal. Honourable Horn raised an important issue when the program was circulated, dealing with the issue of our meeting with the judge president of Gauteng with regard to case lines. We are still in contact with the office to try and find an appropriate date that we would meet with the judge president. We think that the issue of the case line management is one of the pillars of the justice system, and it has to be prioritized. So we'll come back to the committee when we have found an appropriate date as to take the matter forward. But we think that it was an important matter that was raised by Honourable Horn. We would need really to have a way of really ensuring that the decision we take find their expression in our program. Our program is very tight, but it does not also mean that we should not program the decision that the committee has taken. There is also an issue that Honourable Janji raised again when we're dealing with the issues of the magistrate, that we still need to have that meeting with the chairperson of the magistrate commission, the judge, and the magistrate commission on the issues that were raised. So all of those issues, we'll be dealing with them going forward. Thank you very much, the Minister.
No, just to get clarity, have you finished the cyber crimes bill now?
Yes.
You didn't vote. Does that matter?
Sorry?
You didn't vote. Does that matter?
There was no objection.
No unanimous agreement.
Okay. Just the other thing was, Chair, you had raised it at the beginning of the meeting. I had raised with you the problem of the agenda item on Friday on the state liability bill, just in terms of the availability of officials. The acting DG will be accompanying the minister to Scopa. That's DDG Kale Pile, and who was going to do it, and then Mr. Henk Dupriere is unwell. So if it's possible for that section, I mean, maybe we can look at doing it next week, because I think some spots have now opened with the decision to have screenings and not do the interviews next week.
Okay. Honourable Members, can we take one of the days to deal with the state liability days? One of the days that we were going to be using for the interviews.
Agree, Chair.
There's no objection.
Yeah.
On that note, I think we should allow people like Honorable Mohammed and Honorable Glenys Breitenbach, because they must still drive to Parliament for the sitting, to have time to go and prepare
yeah.
and drive to Parliament. And Honorable John Jeffries. Thank you very much, Honorable Members. The meeting is adjourned.
Except Breitenbach, I'm only in Parliament. She doesn't have.
Thank you,
Richard. It's because of you, Richard.